Chapter 21. All in All. In love, if love be love, if love be ours, faith and unfaith can ne'er be equal powers. Unfaith in aught is want of faith in all. It is the little rift within the lute that by and by will make the music mute, and ever widening slowly silence all. The little rift within the lover's lute, or little pitted speck in garnered fruit, that rotting inward slowly moulders all. It is not worth the keeping, let it go, but shall it? Answer, darling, answer no, and trust me not at all, or all in all. Lord Alfred Tennyson, All in All. The hollow place in Cullen's chest is still there when he wakes, but it feels more like exhaustion than actual emptiness. He lies in bed a long time, watching the sunlight pour in through the gaps in his ceiling, light and shadows moving as the canvas flaps in the wind. There are worse ways to spend a morning, but eventually hunger gets the better of him and he sits up. It's only a very small surprise to find Marin slumped against the far wall, asleep with her head lolling at an angle that promises pain later. Cullen's barely sat up before her eyes snap open and to him. She winces as she straightens, her hand going to the side of her neck. "Sir," she greets him, and her tone somehow manages to be respectfully defiant. "Good morning," he says. He discovers that the difference between exhaustion and emptiness is that exhaustion breaks apart for humor more easily. "How long have you been here?" "A little while, sir," she says evasively. Then she ruins her own attempted dodge by looking him straight in the eye and saying, "Sir, I want you to know that whatever happens, I hold your secrets as close as I hold the Inquisition's." "Is something happening?" he asks, amusement growing. "No, sir. I just wanted you to know. I wouldn't tell anyone about anything you didn't want known." "About Bull and Dorian," she means. And it's his turn to wince, realizing why neither of them is here in the bright light of day, when sneaking out of his office would be anything but sneaky. Maker's breath, he's made a mess of his life, hasn't he? And he can't even blame this part on Uldred or Meredith. Marin misinterprets his wince and hastens to say, "They left before dawn, sir. Anyone who saw them wouldn't have been sober enough to know their own mother." He waves this off, swinging his feet to the floor, careful to keep the blankets over his lap. "I'll be down in a moment," he says, and she makes her way to the ladder, moving about as stiffly as he would expect after sleeping on his floor. Alone again, Cullen looks back at his ceiling, or more accurately, at his lack of ceiling, and judges the time to be about noon. Not that he's used to seeing noon sunlight up here, but he can't regret it, not when he feels as if he could roll over and go back to sleep for another day. His bladder and stomach object loudly enough that he sighs and gets up, surprised at how shaky his legs feel. At least his clothes are easy to find, folded neatly on top of the chest. His coat appears to have vanished, though he distinctly remembers draping it over the foot of the bed last night. Down in his office, he finds Marin deep in conversation with one of Josephine's runners. After a moment, Cullen realizes with some amusement that the topic of their so serious discussion is a shipment of lace recently arrived in Skyhold. Why anyone thought a fortress needs such a thing is a mystery, but listening to Marin and Josephine's runner, Cullen is forced to acknowledge that the unknown merchant may know more than Cullen about such things. If what he overhears is any indication, the lace will all be sold before nightfall. The climb down the ladder has left him unexpectedly worn out. Unwilling to admit it, Cullen sits at his desk and pretends to go through his papers while he waits for the trembling to pass. There's just as much paper as there ever was, the rest of the world having apparently not yet received the message that Corypheus is dead. He supposes he can't complain, since it's only been a matter of days. Listening to Marin and the runners discuss projects for which they might need lace, Cullen is oddly soothed. Marin is a soldier, from her short cropped hair to her very practical boots, and her dedication to the Inquisition is beyond question. That she feels safe enough to discuss something so impractical as lace and dresses gives Cullen a faint echo of the pride he should have felt before, standing in the hall while people congratulated the empty husk he'd become. The runner leaves soon enough, and Marin bends all her considerable attention to the reports piled on Cullen's desk. There's more than enough to keep both of them busy, and they speak rarely, past the point where they need words to communicate. Another runner brings them lunch, which Marin makes him eat by staring at him until he puts something into his mouth. Her expression is perfectly respectful the entire time, and perfectly uncompromising, and when he tries to return to his paperwork with his meal half finished, she does it again. Cullen laughs weakly the second time, and sets aside his papers to concentrate on eating. He's too aware of all the responsibilities piled on his desk to actually taste any of what passes his lips, but he eats until she's satisfied, before picking up his pen once more. It's not even dinner time before the exhaustion sends him back to bed, and he sleeps fitfully until he feels Dorian's hand on his forehead, and his voice once more whispering, "Sleep." Most of the following week passes the same way. He eats, he sleeps, he does paperwork, and on no particularly consistent schedule. On one day, he might be asleep at midnight and answering his correspondence at noon, and the next day do exactly the opposite. The only constant is that he's never alone, not even when he sleeps. And he soon learns the pattern of his guards. If the sun is up, he wakes to Marin. If it's after dark, Bull or Dorian. At some point, his room acquires a chair, and that they manage to haul it up without waking him tells him exactly how hard he's sleeping. His coat also reappears, clean and showing no sign that it was ever used as a handkerchief. When he's awake, he works through the papers that continue to gather on his desk, and there are always plenty of those. While he knew it wouldn't all somehow magically vanish with Corypheus, he didn't expect to have more. But more is what he has. So much more, he's considering bringing on another clerk. He could spend his entire day signing his name and still not get through everything. Fortunately, Marin does a passable imitation of his signature, and he trusts her to know what he needs to see and what can be better handled by someone else. He stays in his office or his room for the most part, allowing his guards to bring him food rather than visiting the hall. More Templars have arrived in Skyhold, and now wherever he goes, there's always at least one watching him. So long as he stays in his office, he doesn't have to face them, or the things they want from him. He has no strength to spare or wisdom to impart, no matter how desperate they look. On the eighth day, he wakes in the dark to find Iron Bull keeping him company. Without opening his eyes, Cullen recognizes the sound of his breathing, the way the leather of his harness creaks. He thinks he can even smell him, leather and metal and clean sweat. But that might be just his imagination.
"Sleep all right?" Bull asks.
"Too much." Cullen opens his eyes without sitting up. There's only a single candle lit, leaving Bull mostly in shadows. "My body seems to be trying to make up for every single hour lost over the last year."
"Well, eat before you get back to that, so Dorian doesn't fuss at me."
Something lands beside him on the bed, and Cullen feels around until he comes up with an apple. Remembering Dorian feeding him an apple, one piece at a time, makes him smile, so long as he's careful not to remember too much about the rest of the night.
"So, tell me about the apples,"
Bull says, as Cullen struggles to a sitting position.
"Because Dorian had that same look on his face."
Cullen flushes, and takes a big bite while he tries to think of an answer he can give without stuttering. Not that it's a hardship to eat. This apple, too, tastes as if it was on the tree yesterday. Either Skyhold has been especially lucky in its provisioning, or someone is picking through a lot of apples to find the good ones for him. Perhaps two someones. He's finished half of it before he says, "Dorian brought me an apple once, and, fed it to me."
"And had a good time doing it?"
Cullen flushes a deeper shade of red, and Bull says with some amusement,
"I'll take that as a yes."
"Yes," Cullen mutters indistinctly around another mouthful. There's more food than just the apple, and Cullen eats enough to make Bull happy. He's tired again, but not sleepy. So he slides a little ways down into the bed and says to the canvas overhead, "I've been thinking about what you said. About failure."
"Oh?"
Bull says, shifting in his chair so he can prop his feet on the end of the mattress.
"I feel like I'm at war with myself. Like every day is a fight against this weight that I can't ever get rid of." "I guess that's one way to look at it."
Cullen takes a deep breath and says the part that scares him when he wakes up in the middle of the night. "It's a fight I can never win."
"Seems to me like you win it every time you get through to morning," Bull says.
Frustrated, Cullen tries again. "If I win a fight every day, then I'm still at war. A war I can't ever win. And I only have to lose one fight."
"Sounds a lot like being a mercenary,"
Bull says, serious but unconcerned.
"Or a Templar, I'm guessing. Unless you killed every last mage in the world."
There was a time in his life where that had seemed a reasonable solution. That, or preemptively making every one of them tranquil. Perhaps the greatest gift Meredith gave him was showing him the danger of treating all mages as the enemy. Her madness a glimpse of where he might end up if he wasn't careful. When Cullen doesn't say anything, Bull asks,
"So, what's the difference between this fight and being a Templar?"
Cullen shrugs. He has no answer, but his gut remains unconvinced. "It just is," he says. "I can't explain it. I just know it here." He touches his fingers to the center of his chest.
"That's not knowing. That's feeling," Bull says. "And some feelings are habits."
"So now you're going to tell me what I should feel?" Cullen asks, eyebrows rising.
"No. I'm telling you that just because you feel it doesn't mean you shouldn't think about it."
Before Cullen can answer, Bull drops his feet from the side of the bed and reaches for something on the floor.
"But enough of that. You tired?"
He holds up a deck of cards, high enough that Cullen can see even from his supine position. Wicked Grace with two people isn't the most interesting game in the world, but they play a few hands until Dorian arrives, popping through the hole in the floor like he's under the influence of his own haste spell. "I want you to know," he says, then pauses to kiss Cullen. "I want you to know that I showed great restraint and did not do any permanent damage to the Templar who keeps lingering outside your door." Another pause, this time to kiss Bull. "And despite the fact that I would have been here quite a while ago if he'd moved like a reasonable person."
Cullen groans. "When did that start?"
"Aha!" Dorian crows, sprawling on the bed so he can look at Cullen's cards. "So I could have vented my wrath on him and not suffered yours in turn?"
"You and Marin can do whatever you like to him," Cullen says, rubbing his eyes. "Andraste's tits, why can't they leave me alone?"
All three of them know the answer to that question, and Bull and Dorian wisely refrain from voicing it aloud. "Well," Dorian says, giving Cullen's cards another glance, "since you have possibly the most atrocious hand I've seen in a long time, I think you should start over and deal me in." Cullen's hand isn't actually bad, but he's not about to pass up the opportunity to change the subject. He tosses his cards onto the pile and gestures at them in invitation. Dorian sits up and crosses his legs as Bull shuffles and redeals, and the conversation does indeed move on to other topics. Bull tells a story Cullen hasn't heard before, one that ends with the Inquisitor slipping off a rock in the Forbidden Oasis and landing on the head of the giant they were all trying to sneak past. When the story is nearly done, Cullen realizes he does recognize it after all, from the significantly less detailed version in the Inquisitor's report that somehow failed to mention the slipping and falling that Bull spends so much time describing in loving detail. As soon as that story is finished, Dorian immediately has to try to top it with one of his own. It's a story Cullen has heard before, but Dorian's gestures, not to mention his imitation of the fops at the Orlesian court, are much more interesting than Cassandra's terse summary. They turn it into a competition, Bull and Dorian digging for the most ridiculous stories they can think of, while Cullen laughs and loses most of his coin. Until Dorian smirks up at Bull with a careful deliberation Cullen's seen too many times to mistake. Blankets, cards, and coins are shoved aside, and then their hands and mouths are everywhere. It's not quite as frantic as it was after their return from the wilds, but the same undercurrent is there, that need for reassurance that they're all still alive. Cullen winds up on his back, Bull fucking his mouth while Dorian sucks his cock. There's no need for rope or magic, not with Dorian's weight pinning his legs and Bull's thighs pressing into his chest. One of Bull's hands wraps around both of his wrists, holding them to the mattress, while his other hand twists in Cullen's hair, pulling hard enough to sting. Cullen digs his heels into the bed, arching up into Dorian's mouth as much as he can while he fights for breath, around and between Bull's thrusts. When Bull is finished and Dorian sucked Cullen until lights flash in front of his eyes, leaving him dazed and shaking, Bull lets Cullen up and tugs Dorian into his lap to stroke him with one slick fist, kissing him hard. Dorian groans into the kiss, his hands gripping Bull's horns, and Cullen leans against Bull's back so he can run his tongue along the muscle leading from Bull's neck to his shoulder. He rests his hands on Dorian's thighs, feeling them tense as Dorian's head falls back, then tense even more as Bull bites his collarbone and he falls apart, whispering in broken Tavine. Later, Cullen lies awake and listens to them breathe. Bull's chest rises and falls under his cheek, and Dorian mutters occasionally into his hair, nonsense words from whatever dream currently holds him. At one point, that muttering turns anxious, and he begins to shift restlessly. As Cullen reaches back to touch his shoulder, Bull's breathing changes and his hand stretches over Cullen to pet Dorian's hair until he quiets. On its return, that hand touches Cullen's face lightly, lingering on the curve of his cheek, before dropping back to the bed. Cullen turns his face into Bull's shoulder and tries to sleep. He manages a few fitful bursts, kept awake not by nightmares but by a slow unwinding of memory. From Bull pinning him down on the mage's tower, all the way to Dorian's terrified face as he clung to the ladder and stared at Cullen, and on to the empty bed he's woken to every morning for the last week. In some ways, he feels like he's traveled back in time, before the wilds, before Maddox, before Redcliffe, to the easy friendship and easier sex of the first weeks of their relationship. It's where he thought he wanted to be, until he had it back and he realized just how much it's still missing. He wants this, but not just this. The thoughts crowding his head mean he's already half awake when Dorian slips from the bed and begins to dress. Cullen wants to ask him to stay, but doesn't think fast enough, and Dorian's goodbye kiss makes him lightheaded. Watching Dorian kiss Bull, using his horns to keep his head still, doesn't help him think any more clearly, and by the time he's assembled words into a coherent sentence, Dorian is already gone. Cullen stares down the ladder after him, frustrated by his own ability to communicate. Is "I want you to stay" really so difficult?
All right,
Bull asks, from his seat on the edge of the bed. On the crate beside him, the candle flickers in the drafts from the holes in the roof. If Cullen can't say the words to Dorian, talking about them with Bull is 10 times harder. Unsure how to start, Cullen instead asks a question he's been thinking about, off and on, for the last few weeks. "Dorian grabs your horns," he says, forcing himself to face Bull, "and you don't stop him. But you stopped me."
"Does it bother you?"
Bull asks.
"Not exactly."
Cullen rubs the back of his neck and gropes for the right words. "It bothers me that I don't understand why."
"You and Dorian want different things," Bull says, watching him closely. "He likes to play at letting someone control him, at giving up the power. But you want the reality. He wants to stay in control. At least a little bit, and you want to give it all up."
Cullen has a moment of clarity, brief but dazzling.
"What do you want?"
he asks, his mind finally, firmly in the present. He's not talking about sex, not anymore, and he knows Bull knows it. Bull looks at him a long time, his face as perfectly blank as it's ever been, giving nothing away. Cullen realizes he's holding his breath and forces himself to inhale.
"Trust," Bull says eventually, and it's not even close to the answer Cullen was expecting.
"Trust?" Bull seems to give the answer serious thought, studying Cullen's face.
"Dorian trusts me not to take more control from him than he's willing to give. You trust me to take it all, and give it all back at the end."
Or maybe they are still talking about sex? Cullen starts to say something, to explain his original question better, but Bull isn't finished.
"You trust me," Bull says. "Both of you trust me. With the thing you guard the most. You fought and bled and sacrificed to be in control of your life, and then you hand that control over to me like a gift. Even if it's only for a short time. I want to be able to trust you the same way. I want to know that you'll tell me what you need, and that you'll stay if I need something, or if Dorian needs something. I want to know that you won't walk away."
There's no need to add, "again." That part Cullen understands just fine. But he's not sure about the rest of it. Or at least, he's not sure how he would prove something like that. He can't go back and remake those decisions, no matter how much he wants to now. He grabs the only thing he can think of and says hesitantly, "I haven't..." He falters, embarrassed, and tries again. "It's been only you and Dorian since..." Bull is smiling, but he's also shaking his head. And Cullen stops without trying to finish the sentence.
"That doesn't mean much under the Kune. I may be Talvashoth now, but I haven't left that part behind."
His hand flexes on his knee, once, before he stills it.
"And before you ask, it's not some public declaration I want either."
"Then what?"
"The only thing I want to know is that you'll be here when it matters."
"But I don't know how to prove that," Cullen says, frustrated.
"One day at a time, Cadan, the same way you learned to trust me."
There have been other opportunities to ask about that word, and Cullen's always avoided them, probably because he knew he wouldn't like the answer before. He licks his lips and asks,
"Cadan?"
Bull examines his face again, more closely than before. It's an intent look, terrifying as it measures every inch of him and weighs everything he's ever said or done.
"Cadan,"
Bull says, after a long silence.
"My heart."
The look he gives Cullen now is the same one he wore in the library, after Dorian returned from Redcliffe and his father. It asks a question, and promises no judgment whichever way he answers. Cullen hardly feels stronger than he did then, feels weaker in so many ways, but he does know how to learn from his mistakes. His lips form around the unfamiliar word without giving it voice, testing it the way he tested Kato the first time he heard it, and for much the same reason. It's a word with weight, not to be used lightly.
"Cadan,"
he says, when he's sure he'll say it right, not just the right sound, but the right emotion. Only after he's said it does he realize how neatly Bull has brought the conversation around in a circle. A month ago, even 2 weeks ago, he would have been miles from this room already, in spirit if not in body. Right now, he's terrified, but he has no desire to run. Instead, he kneels in front of Bull, despite the protests from his joints, and puts a hand on Bull's knee. One of Bull's hands touches Cullen's face, thumb brushing against his lips, and Cullen says it again.
"You call Dorian Cadan too. And I mean it, just as much as when I say it to you," Bull says.
There's a hint of uncertainty in his voice that Cullen's never heard before, and never wants to hear again. He smiles against the pad of Bull's thumb. "A bit greedy, don't you think? Who needs two hearts?"
"I do," Bull says gravely,
and Cullen has a moment of panic, wondering if his words sounded serious instead of teasing. Then Bull laughs and pulls him up, to tumble both of them onto the bed with Cullen on top. His hands move over Cullen's skin, rough and soothing, and Cullen drifts a little, just at the edge of sleep.
"Almost dawn,"
Bull murmurs.
"Time for me to go,"
he nudges Cullen, the message clear.
Cullen doesn't move.
Do you want to go?
No, Bull answers immediately.
But I also don't mind, if that's what you want.
Stay, he says, and that word is as terrifying as Kadan, but he means it just as much.
It doesn't matter to me if no one ever knows but the three of us, Bull says. There's only one thing I want.
His arm around Cullen's waist makes it clear what that is. Cullen still doesn't move, and neither of them says anything else until sunshine is streaking through the gaps in the roof to cast alternating patterns of light and shadow across their skin.